Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Today on Off Taco Empire, Minnesota's all-out attack comes up short. Iowa takes Penix and Indiana to Pound Town. Maryland and Purdue manage P5 wins. Michigan State and Penn State travel west and put up big. And Nebraska's week zero loss ages like month-old Midwestern dairy. Tune in for more details this week on Off Taco Empire.
Your source for Big Ten talk, it's Off Taco Empire!
Welcome back to Off Taco Empire, the official podcast of Off Taco Empire, and your source for everything about Big Ten football that there is. And there was nothing more Big Ten football than Wisconsin heading into halftime against Penn State with a 0-0 tie. Wouldn't you agree? I'm Steve Braun, a.k.a. Thumbsaurus. I'm here with Andy Krzyzewski, as usual. We're here to talk about Week 1, where the Big Ten led off with one of the biggest games imaginable. And by biggest, I mean with a 1.
I mean most postponed in terms of the Temple versus Rutgers matchup. Just had to wait a couple more days to build the anticipation, you see. The weather was a pretext to cancel that. On that point you mentioned, though, Wisconsin-Penn State being tied scoreless at halftime, this is why every single school needs to have at least an alternate logo that is the primary letter of their school, so that when their games are tied at zeros late in the proceedings, we can make more funny words out of the scores.
Whoop!
Or poo! Whichever. So Penn State just having the Nittany Lion head logo as their only logo. You're not participating. We still saw your offense was bad in the first half. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. We're going to go in chronological order because we had games spread out over 3 days, and then elsewhere in college football, the games continued for 2 more days after that. I do like that about Labor Day, to be honest.
Yeah, so I'm hitting what seems to be our most common wind fight tri booster of the week, which is water. I looked around my place for anything else I felt like drinking, and I'm detoxing after a very, very long weekend of college football.
A pretty good weekend overall, though. Some of the more high-profile games really disappointed in terms of the competitiveness or the interesting factor, if that's a word for what we saw on the field. But we got some good games from unexpected places. And this is where I'm going to point out, from our last week's discussion, that I'm always right and everyone should listen to me, because I said that Minnesota would be able to keep it a competitive game against Ohio State, and they did. And I honestly think if Mo Ibrahim doesn't get hurt in the third quarter and take all the wind out of Minnesota's sails, maybe it's a game into the fourth quarter. Now, granted, the ultimate result is what most people expected. Ohio State wins, and they win by 2 scores, and they put up 45 points without a whole lot of effort, but there is a defensive touchdown in there. There are several long plays in there, which basically the problem and the reason that Minnesota would have lost this game even if Ibrahim had stayed healthy was that their defense remains a disorganized mess in the back end. On his two touchdown catches, I believe, I think on both of them, there's nobody within 15 yards of Olave when he catches the ball. How do you lose track of Chris Olave to that extent? Like, I get they got another guy you got to watch, but the field's not that big. Like, you should be able to keep track of the All-American.
Just how much value was it that they were able to get to Garrett Wilson all the time, considering that all he did was made them miss and get the first down anyway?
Sure, on most of the swing passes, then on his long touchdown, he's like, oh, well, I'm in the slot and there's a safety opposite me. I bet his hips don't match mine. And so he made a little stutter step like he was running a corner route and goes to the post instead, and the safety's trying to pick up his own pelvis, and
they
it's an easy touchdown.
Not lie. So,
yeah.
The main takeaway here, if you're Ohio State, is C.J. Stroud has some work to do.
Yeah, especially early on. We saw him miss some open throws early. He settled into a little bit of a rhythm after he hit some long throws, which maybe is a little counterintuitive, but give a young quarterback like that a shot of confidence, and it's easy to see how that goes. And, you know, we discussed on our way to Chicago this weekend that for Ohio State, it's really not a bad play for a young quarterback to just have him flip the ball to Wilson on a swing or a screen 7 or 8 times a game and tell the opposing defense, hey, tackle that guy. Prove to me that you can tackle that guy right at the line of scrimmage. And even if you have him dead to rights and all your defenders are lined up, he's still likely to make 7 to 10 yards out of it.
Well, you did notice, I mean, you did note that that Stroud looked not the part of the best quarterback in the Big Ten. Of course, you know, we went with Michael Penix, who also didn't look like the best quarterback in the Big Ten this week. But we're getting ahead of, but not to get too
details, details, details.
It's weird because it feels like, I just keep feeling, didn't we already discuss this game? And it only feels like that because it happened 5 days ago.
Yeah.
It's Tuesday.
Yeah. So, of course, we're recording a little bit late here because, as mentioned, we were both gone for the weekend, returned in the afternoon yesterday, and honestly just weren't feeling it. So, from the Minnesota perspective, losing...
What a series of gut punches.
Yeah, losing Ibrahim sucks, and that's... They already had Chris Ottman Bell out, but it sounds as though he's going to return at some point. So, if you're looking for silver linings, they did find a new, certainly at worst, a new number two receiver, and they were pronouncing it Dalen Wright on the broadcast. It is spelled like your run-of-the-mill Dylan, but if Dalen is what it is, Dalen is what it is, the transfer from Texas A&M.
Are you sure that they weren't splitting the difference between that and Dylan, who is, of course, one of the best five, one of the top five hottest rappers out there?
Dalen Wright, one of the five Dylan. Best top receivers of all time.
Dylan, Dylan, and Dylan. Because he spits hot fire. So all those bad things happened to Minnesota in a very short time span. They were leading, and then suddenly they lost the lead, and then they immediately gave up another touchdown, and then their star player went out. So things can change fast. It felt like felt a bit more like watching motor racing and your guy hits the wall leading.
Yeah, more or less, in that it's a pretty sudden reversal of fortune that snowballs into a thing that you can't recover from. So, again, silver linings, they did get a decent game out of Dalen Wright. And although Mo Ibrahim has gone down, they have had success in finding the next man up at running back in the past.
And one of the reasons is because their offensive line did look pretty good.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons not to be too down on their future ability to run the ball, because they did make plenty of hay against the Buckeyes' front seven.
Yeah, and that being said, I mean, Ohio State's defense has been their question mark for a few seasons now. They're certainly not going to face another offense that good the rest of the year. So I guess if you're Minnesota, you take this loss for what it is, which is, you know, what you expected, and you do find some positives out of it, even losing an excellent player like Ibrahim. So
I mean, they might actually play more consistent offenses, but they certainly won't play another one that can, you know, that where the coaches can say, gee, I sure would like another insurance touchdown. Let's put out a generational talent at running back that's just been sitting on our bench this whole game.
Yeah, yeah, and just flip him a little screen, and then he takes it 70 yards, because not only is he probably one of the strongest guys on the field, he's also the fastest. So, yep, Travion Henderson is the next guy who you're counting down days until he leaves for the draft and hope that the next guy's not quite as good.
Really, all you can do is hope that he gets mad that he didn't get all the carries in that game. I mean, that seems to be the only way those guys ever leave. Not ever, but, you know, leave without crushing you a few times.
Yeah. Also, I suppose it's also worth pointing out that a guy who I don't think anyone outside the program, because, you know, the thing is, Ryan Day in the offseason did talk a lot about Mayan Williams. And it was one of those things where, as an outsider, you look at, like, yeah, okay, sure, this, you know, former 3-star is going to take snaps away from Master Teague and keep Travion Henderson off the field, but he kind of did. And if he hadn't cracked off a 70-yard touchdown early in the game, the pressure on Ohio State would have been substantially higher at the beginning, because they had that little bit of pressure release there. Stroud was able to take his time and settle in, and, you know, eventually the pressure of Ohio State's talent finds the cracks in Minnesota's defense and washes it all away in the blink of an eye, really. So, yeah, I think there's a couple lessons to be here. First is, I still think Minnesota is going to be a factor in the West with that run game. They've got some backups, none of whom have taken anything like the load that Ibrahim has, but they've cycled through guys in the past. Bryce Williams is the guy who 2 years ago had, or maybe it was even 3 years ago now, had a substantial role and has just fallen off the radar because they haven't needed him. I would actually think he's probably the best candidate to take that lead role, even though he's not been the first or even second guy off the bench when Ibrahim was healthy. So all that being said, we'll talk about the game that you and I went and saw in person. which is Michigan State going to Northwestern. And I'll tell you, as a fan of a team that's had a really terrible offense the last several years, it sure would have been fun to see my running back go 75 yards on the opening play from scrimmage. But you and me and my eight other bachelor party bros were standing in the security line at one of Northwestern's gate as their mom-and-pop stadium operation was operating two metal detectors per entrance point, of which I assume there are only four, because we came in on the south side of the stadium and only went past one gate. There's probably two on the other end. That makes a total of eight entry points for however many thousands of people are getting in. It's not like Northwestern's never hosted Michigan State before. They know we have fans in the city, and they come up with eight metal detectors. It's fucking embarrassing!
Yeah, so it took us around a half an hour, and I just became increasingly frustrated and started trying to get some people's attention by I just started insisting to no one in particular that Northwestern fans should turn around and go home as Michigan State was in position to make it a 14-0 game. Nothing to see here. Go back to your book learning. Just get out of here. I guess it's a viable strategy for them to keep out visiting fans, you know, slow their entrance into the stadium into a trickle, but it's ultimately not, you know, mattering so far in this first quarter, was my thought, as, it seems to be all Michigan State. And you can tell that because the crowd is very happy.
The crowd is making a lot of noise, yeah. And given that I bought the tickets from the athletic department directly, I may still do the Big Ten thing and write them a sternly phrased email. So to get into the game a little bit.
Dear sir or madam.
To whom it may concern.
Dear sirs and or madams and or combinations thereof.
It is fun to see that Michigan State has an actual threat on offense again in Kenneth Walker III, though. He was excellent, and the win on the road in a game they controlled most of the way is the story. But to get there with this, 264 yards and four touchdowns is the kind of production you haven't seen from Michigan State since Le'Veon Bell. And Bell would need 40 to 50 touches to do that. Walker only had 23 carries. I think he might have had one or two receptions.
I mean, it's one of the better performances in a conference game in recent memory for a running back.
You can subtract that 75-yard run on the opening play, and it's still almost 200 on damn near 10 yards a carry for three more touchdowns. Like honestly, the guy he reminded me most of in his running style is actually Amir Abdullah, except he didn't fumble. He's got stop, start, change of direction, burst, power, a lot of stuff to like. I haven't seen him use much as a receiver, and I don't know if they're going to bother because they have a lot of backs they want to use. But yeah, they play Youngstown State this weekend. We'll get into that in the preview episode. I can't imagine they're going to need more than 15 carries out of him to put that game away. It's easy to imagine that he's capable of bigger things. I mean, if this is the kind of production he gets from this, if you do have to give him 30 carries in game, what can he do with that? So that was very exciting. I didn't really know for sure what they would do with the starting quarterback. I probably would have guessed Anthony Russo because they brought the guy in as a grad transfer. He physically looks much more like all the quarterbacks they're recruiting, so you get a pretty good idea. That's what Mel Tucker wants in a quarterback, ideally. But he ends up going with Peyton Thorne, and Thorne, to his credit, showed a lot of improvement from last season, especially in decision making. He picked up a few third downs, but there were also other pressured plays that last year he would have just uncorked a throw into coverage and probably turned it over, but he avoided that this year. Still don't know about his ultimate ceiling with the deep ball, and with a couple receivers like Jaden Reed and Jalen Naylor, that would be a little bit of a shame, but given that this run game, especially the offensive line, now that Jarrett Horst, the transfer from Arkansas State, is in at tackle, they look so much better running the ball.
It's hard to really say what exactly he left on the table as far as the deep passing game is concerned, because he didn't seem to see Naylor that often compared to Reed.
That's true, and it's an easy thing to conclude that given they were high school teammates, perhaps there is a preferential relationship there that might be to the detriment of the other receivers, but it was also a low-volume passing attack. Northwestern does have a pretty strong secondary. I would imagine, again, that the coaching staff in film sessions is like doing the thing where you draw on the screen and it show, like, they're just like taking a Sharpie and like drawing like five circles around Brandon Joseph, like, don't throw near this guy, given the season that he had last season. And they didn't give Joseph a chance to impact the game or make any plays. Northwestern did force a fumble, but it was late in the game when it was really already out of hand. And from the Northwestern perspective, then, the defense obviously becomes the huge question mark here now. And it is true that in the last 3 years now, Michigan State has gone 3-0 and scored about 33 points per game against Northwestern, which is like 15 points higher than their scoring average. So there's some weird alchemy at play there to an extent. But this is also the first season under a new defensive coordinator in Jim O'Neill. A guy where there's maybe some whispers of a little bit of a nepotistic relationship, an old buddy of Fitzgerald's.
So it's actually an ideal spot for MSU to play Northwestern in because, one, you've got the first game under a new coordinator, and two, it's Northwestern in September replacing a lot of starters. I mean, that's just a nightmare for Northwestern and just exactly when I wish Illinois could play them.
Yeah, you know, I'm keeping the recording of this game on the old DVR, sticking that away like a six-year-old vintage and letting it age because I feel like it's going to turn out looking a lot better towards the end of the year. Hunter Johnson, who we kind of raised our eyebrows at as the starter, certainly looked the part. I mean, he looked every bit of a five-star quarterback. Didn't take a ton of shots deep down the field, but did complete a couple when he tried.
You know, he made some accurate throws, but he also made more difficult throws than he really needed to because he very much went to his first read. He wasn't looking through his progressions that well. I noticed that he did, in fact, make some of those throws, but it was also like, man, you didn't have to do that one.
That's true. While it was impressive,
it was also kind of like, you know, maybe against a more ball-hawking secondary, he wouldn't have gotten away with those.
It's true, and there is also... So if you're looking at room for improvement for Michigan State, there certainly is some on the defensive side in particular in that when they attempted to rush without blitzing, they did not get home. Northwestern's got a pretty good offensive line, but when Johnson had a clean pocket, which he generally did if Michigan State didn't blitz, he was able to find his guys. You saw what we're going to see this year, that he's got Bryce Kurtz and Stephon Robinson as go-to receivers. The run game, the averages aren't going to look too terrible because Evan Hull had like a 60-yarder or something. Like, it may not have been that long, but it was at least a 40 to 45, 50-yarder. And again, subtracting that outlier play, their per-carry average was pretty poor. But it was also, I think it was also a situation where not knowing what they would see from a new starting quarterback, maybe Mel Tucker wanted to make Johnson beat them. But they did also send blitzes from a lot more creative places than the previous staff did. So you had sacks, a sack from Quavarius Crouch, linebacker, and then sacks from Xavier Henderson out of safety spot, and Ronald Williams out of the corner. So they've made it pretty clear they're going to be throwing guys in from everywhere. And if they see other offensive lines this good, and Miami will be that in 2 weeks, it's pretty clear that to get pressure, they're going to have to blitz.
You know, unless their spirit is completely broken like other teams that have opened up with Bama in week one.
We'll see about that. It'll be I don't know who Miami plays this week, but yeah.
Homeboy had to surrender the turnover chain after a replay review.
Oh my God, I forgot all about that. That is true, yes. Miami thought they had, I don't even remember if it was an interception or a fumble or what, but I think it was a fumble because it was overturned, right?
Yeah, so the guy was wearing the turnover chain on the sideline for a solid 2 to 3 minutes.
And he's looking up at the scoreboard, and then there's like, you can hear like indistinct over the loudspeaker. He just like puts his head down and takes the chain off and hands it to the coach. That's got like, talk about the most, like the least hype moment of your life, perhaps. But yeah, I have no complaints at all. It's a win on the road. It's an offense that looks dynamic and interesting. Defense still has some things to adjust, but look, here's what I'll say, which is that Tucker was right to bring in all those transfers, man, because a lot of them played. A lot of them are MSU's best players now. Like, aside from, you know, Xavier Henderson, the best players on MSU's team were all guys Tucker brought in this offseason. So no question that he made the right choice there.
So moving on to the big tennis game of the week. We had Penn State 16, Wisconsin 10, and basically Wisconsin, it was kind of a work of art to lose this game by them because they controlled the ball for a vast majority of this one.
Yeah, a work of art in that it was a very complicated thing to do to accomplish what they pulled off, and I still don't quite get it. They go, I think, 1 for 4 in the red zone. They had a field goal blocked. Graham Mertz threw an interception on fourth and goal to go.
They had 29 first downs to 11 for Penn State. They held the ball for 43 minutes, yet they turned the ball over 3 times. you know, red zone fumble, a blocked field goal. They outrushed Penn State like 90-5 through the first half of the game.
Yeah, and it has to be said here. Well, all right, first of all, count down anyone's buying Graham Mertz's personally branded stuff this week. And yet their run game was held in check to a sufficient extent. I mean, again, their averages were decent. They did better than Penn State running the ball. But they still needed Graham Mertz to do a few things to win this game, or at least not lose it for them. And the fumbles that we're talking about, it's not like the running back takes the ball and a linebacker just punches it out. These are fumbles on handoffs from Mertz to Malusi. And granted, Malusi's a transfer and he's a new starter. I think because Berger was hurt, actually, I ended up reading that summer because we couldn't figure out why they went with the transfer over the guy who looked like a potential star. But they fumble it twice on handoffs to running backs. And then down the stretch, Mertz has to make the throws and he ends up throwing two interceptions. I get the second one was forced, but expectations for him may need to be recalibrated long-term is all I'm saying.
Because Wisconsin shouldn't have put him in that spot because Wisconsin generally doesn't want to be in a spot where the quarterback has to win them the game.
But he
supposed to be the quarterback that can win them the game.
And that was only the spot they were in because he couldn't even be historical Wisconsin quarterback earlier in the game. Wisconsin's defense was missing Leo Chenal, one of their best linebackers, on COVID protocols. And they still forced Penn State to go 3-and-out on every drive in the first half except one. And even on that drive, Penn State only had one first down, only ran 5 plays on that drive. But then going the other direction, the only 2 serious drives Wisconsin could muster before halftime, they end in a blocked field goal and a lost fumble. So even at home, even in front of your raucous home crowd, the first home crowd you've had at Camp Randall in well over a year, they just couldn't finish drives and turn them into points. And some credit due here, I suppose, to James Franklin, who pulled off his first road win against a top 15 opponent. I think in like 11 or 12 tries, he had, and again, that's not a totally fair stat because a lot of those came at Vanderbilt, okay? And there's something of a difference in losing a road game as Penn State against a highly ranked opponent and losing a road game as Vanderbilt going to Alabama or Georgia or Florida or LSU. It's still, though, the first big road game, you could say, of his career that he's won. They're always a second-half team, and they're a team that's going to find a few big plays eventually. And so even with the offensive frustration they had in the first half, how do they get their points? Well, they break through with a long touchdown pass to Dotson, and then their second touchdown is set up by about a 40-yarder to Dotson. So it's hard to hold a guy like him down forever. Wisconsin doesn't really have a top-shelf shutdown corner anymore.
Boy, he sure did get behind everybody for that second one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just a matter of time, especially because Penn State did stick with the running game to a sufficient extent that Wisconsin had to respect it.
They only ran 18 times, but they eventually started getting a little more than they were. I mean,
they didn't run many plays altogether.
Yeah, most of those were in the second half.
Yeah. And the other thing to point out, defensively, the easy story is always, you know, Brandon Smith, the former superstar recruiting prospect, he's the guy who comes up with the goal line interception on fourth down, the first of the two. Ellis Brooks had a huge day. But I also projected in the offseason that Arnold Ebiketie from Temple would be an instant impact for them on the defensive line because they needed new guys at defensive end, losing Tony and Jason Owe. And I think I was right about that, so I'll give myself a little pat on the back. But I think this game pretty clear. So the national narrative about this game, I think, is going to be, God, what a horrible game. What an ugly thing to watch. Penn State's defense went to Camp Randall and held Wisconsin to 10 points. That, to me, tells me that if Sean Clifford turns into his best self, they are the serious contender to Ohio State that we're all wondering if that team exists.
Yep, especially because we know that if it's not Penn State in the East, then at this point it's probably nobody because the team we picked sure isn't that. But as far as holding Wisconsin to 10 points, they certainly did it in a roundabout way because 2:38 to go in the game, first and goal at the Penn State 1, trailing by 6, and they couldn't turn that. And they turned that into some lost yards and then an interception thrown from, like, the 10.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
again, you have Wisconsin going first and goal at the one.
And not punching it in. It's a thing that would be unheard of recently. So if it feels like we're running a bit long here, worry not. These next few are going to be pretty quick. Rutgers 61, Temple 14. Not a whole lot to say here, except that despite the final scoreline, this one did get interesting for a little bit into the second half. Rutgers jumped out to a 26-0 lead, and then Temple had their touchdowns back-to-back right there, close it to 26-14. And from there, Rutgers finds its footing just fine. I mean, they get defensive touchdowns, they're scoring all over
the place. DeJuan Mathis had gotten into a rhythm. He got a couple of touchdowns, and then all of a sudden, a touchdown went the other way.
Yeah.
And that was all she wrote.
Yeah, and so they did get a little bit more of a test out of a 40-something point margin than you would normally expect.
Temple's bad, and Rutgers has a baseline level of competence that has been kind of unheard of since their first season in the Big Ten.
Yep. Moving on to our next blowout, Nebraska 52, Fordham 7. Don't think we didn't notice, Nebraska, that this game was also tied early in the second quarter. We know perfectly well y'all were reaching for the Tums at one point. And again, granted, final margin is all well and good. We also heartily welcome all-name, all-American, absolute, stone-cold lead pipe lock, Chancellor Brewington, to everyone's collective awareness, and expect him to become the focal point of Nebraska's passing attack forthwith. If you're not getting my man Chancellor 12 targets a game, Scott Frost, you are fucking up, and you deserve the firing that's most likely still coming your way.
And then I want to talk about something else, Fordham. Now, ESPN now credits Ryan Greenhagen, Fordham linebacker, with 31 total tackles.
My dude.
Which breaks an NCAA record since they kept defensive stats officially starting in 2000. That nobody else had more than 8 for Fordham, so that is a hell of an accomplishment.
Dude earned himself an ice bath, and we say since records were kept because it is pretty well known that Mike Singletary had individual games, and I believe in the same season, 1978, of 33 and 35 tackles for Baylor, which says two things. One, you probably already knew Mike Singletary's an insane wrecking machine of a human being football player when he was playing. And two, Baylor was really damn bad, because how do you let that your opponent have that many opportunities to be tackled?
I wonder if anybody ever asked him about his teammates, and I wonder on defense, and I wonder if he ever said, cannot play with him,
cannot win with him,
can't do it.
Presumably so. Elsewhere in blowouts, Michigan 47, Western Michigan 14. Again, another game where it took a much scrutinized program just long enough to assert themselves that their fans probably still caught a little bit of heartburn in a blowout win. The thing was, Western's offensive line really wasn't good enough to let their quarterback get into much of a rhythm or much of a sink and test Michigan's new-look defense. Western Michigan, aside from their nose guard, Ralph Holley, doesn't have anything on defense anymore, so Haskins and Blake Corum had no problem getting considerable yardage on the ground. And Michigan even got a little bump of that good future projection shit as J.J. McCarthy got in, showed off impressive arm strength. Safety was totally out of position, but nonetheless, a downfield crossfield strike to Daylon Baldwin, who strolled in for a touchdown. So you even got to keep alive the specter of the Michigan September Heisman. Hope endures always. But
well, the question is this. Are they going to outthink themselves and make a quarterback controversy? Or do you think they'll just do the smart thing and realize that their most successful teams under Harbaugh were quarterbacked by Jake Rudock and Wilton Spate?
It's an interesting question, and to find what I think will be the answer, I think we would do well to take a look at Michigan's schedule, because the answer to that question is, well, how long before they're out of the Big Ten race? Once upon a time, I would have said that trip to Camp Randall on October 2nd would be the date after which you expect to see the quarterback change. I don't know if that's the case anymore. We'll see what Wisconsin looks like with some time to course correct before they get back into Big Ten action.
And I believe that Penn State's better than Michigan.
Oh, by a mile, especially on defense. Notwithstanding the fact that Michigan has two individual defensive players better than anyone Penn State does, they do not have a better defense overall. And of course, the bad news, the news that even we sympathize with, Ronnie Bell lost for the season on a punt return. The clear number one receiver for Michigan. They do have other options there. We mentioned Baldwin they brought in as a transfer. you know, Cornelius Johnson, Roman Wilson, AJ Henning. They have other guys that can step up and fill that role, presumably, but to lose a guy who's a reliable catch machine, who is very good getting yards after catch, and was a decent, if not explosive, punt returner, all bad news, and certainly you don't want to see that for a guy who's a senior, probably still an NFL draft choice, but we'll see how that goes. Unfortunate news there. Speaking of unfortunate, Iowa 34, Indiana 6.
Well, I guess we were very wrong about Indiana. It could be that Iowa is just a transcendent team on defense this year, but I'm feeling that it's like more likely than not that they are simply a little more towards 9 wins than 8 wins.
Probably so. I think there's a couple things worth noting. First, Michael Penix definitely looked thoroughly rattled by the crowd he saw in Kinnick Stadium. It's true that last year, his first full year as a starter, there were no crowds. And by the time he was throwing his third interception, like you could see on the broadcast, like the routes the receivers are supposed to run all jiggly, and like it's a question mark as to which button you push to throw to that guy. The third interception he threw, his receiver had his back to him, and the defensive back like reached around him to intercept the ball. It's one of those days where it's like, I don't know what this guy's looking at, but he doesn't have it. This isn't going well, and Tom Allen's offensive staff could not find a mid-season or a mid-game correction that made anything work.
It just snowballed out of control for Penix, because I think part of the reason was because they couldn't get anything going in the run game, and then Penix started forcing things early, and he had the two quick turnovers, and he was looking to get it back. I mean, it was just a thing where it all unraveled in such a hurry. One mistake led to another, and ultimately, that's, you know, we viewed this as a game that was going to establish, is Indiana ready to be Iowa? No, they are not. Because if they were ready to be Iowa,
I never thought that was the question.
Because if they were ready to be Iowa, then they would not have let things continue to roll downhill, because that's generally how Iowa's been able to operate.
If they were ready to be Iowa, they probably would have lost this game 17-13.
Absolutely.
Instead of 34-6, because again, they gave them two defensive touchdowns. Iowa doesn't do that. And they would have scratched out a little bit more in the way of offense, but I never thought that was the question. I've never pegged Indiana as being on the Iowa track. They're on the Michigan State mid-stage Mark D'Antonio track. And this kind of game happened to Mark D'Antonio's teams 2010-11, that kind of time frame, where the opponent had his offense figured out. He was not a guy who made adjustments very well on the offensive side of the ball. And the defense actually did about as well as you could expect for that situation. Iowa barely cracked 300 yards of total offense in this game.
Just when you're giving them the ball with short fields.
They didn't even give them short fields. They gave them two defensive touchdowns. Like, that's...
Yeah.
I don't think Indiana is this bad, and I don't think Iowa is this good, but it does have to be said that at this point in the season, every other serious contender in the West has at least one conference loss. This has to be the year that Iowa goes back to Indy with that kind of position, with that kind of jump out of the gate, right? And then, again, the question of what to make of this for Indiana, we'll see if it's first game jitters and feeling a little bit of the pressure of expectation. I mean, how long has it been since Indiana was ranked in the preseason? Or we'll see if it was just kind of a flash in the pan last year, and unfortunately they're going to struggle to be more than a barely bowl-eligible team. We'll see which is the reality.
If you're Iowa, things have to look good right now, because in the West you have Wisconsin's running game doesn't seem to be as proficient, or at the very least doesn't have the upside that is often thought that it does, and their quarterback is turning into a bit of a pumpkin. Minnesota has picked up a conference loss and lost their best player. Illinois is Illinois, and it turns out it was way more Nebraska than Illinois, and they keep losing defensive starters for the season every single week. Northwestern is, you can't count Northwestern out yet.
September Northwestern, yeah. So
and Nebraska is probably not going to be in it, and, you know, who knows about Purdue, but right now you got to put Iowa as absolutely the favorite to win the West. Prohibitively so.
Yeah. We'll move on then to kind of one of the performances that was easier to feel good about. Maryland 30, West Virginia 24. A possible sort of low-key coming-out party for Taulia Tagovailoa. 26 for 36, 332, 3 touchdowns, 0 turnovers. That's a sparkly line against a West Virginia defense that's thought to be still pretty good. They were very good last year and had some turnover, but still had a lot of those pieces around. Neil Brown still thought I was a pretty good defensive coach.
This was a really good game. It was back and forth. Yeah. Maryland limited the West Virginia rushing game pretty well. They wanted to run everything through Letty Brown, and ultimately they only got 16 carries out of him because they were playing from behind and he wasn't getting a whole lot of, you know, he broke off a couple of big ones, but ultimately down to down, it was not. I was impressed with the Maryland defense. I kind of thought that was where they would really struggle in this game and that they would cede control of it, whereas I thought their offense would be a little more jittery than it ended up being.
Yeah,
but they also they had a 120-yard rusher in this game, and Tayon Fleet Davis.
Yep, and the odd thing was, even though they had that big game from Fleet Davis, down the stretch when they were killing the clock, they turned instead to Isaiah Jacobs, I think a converted receiver, and gave him a bunch of carries as well. Not as efficient because West Virginia is stalling out on the run, but they have a couple options in the backfield. And they still have, they have what looks like a pretty potent wide receiver combo with Dante Demas and Rakeem Jarrett. So
each of whom caught a 60-plus yard touchdown pass that was an absolute backbreaker for West Virginia, especially the one late in the fourth quarter to make it a two-score game.
Yep, the pieces are there offensively for Maryland. The defense looks better than I think we expected it to at this point.
Ruben got four turnovers.
Ruben Hippolyte, I think I'm saying that name right, was a guy who jumped out to me on the screen. And we commented extensively, you know, Maryland is relying heavily on this big infusion of front seven talent to turn around their fortunes defensively. So far, so good. Look, this is a Power Five conference opponent. This is a non-conference win. This certainly puts you in position to get to 7-8 wins. Should make a bowl game, no problem, with the rest of their non-con, I believe. And so hard to give anything but high marks across the board for the Terps. We mentioned Iowa being the clear contender, the clear number one contender in the West. And if you're looking around for other possible bolts, you know, wrenches in the gears there, do you consider Purdue after a 30-21 win over Oregon State? Probably not by itself, not because of that data point alone.
But also, Jeff Brohm has been pretty good against Iowa, all things considered.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, Purdue starts this game by giving up a touchdown march to Oregon State like right away, and then they assert themselves, they take control of the game. I think this was a bad weather game. Wasn't it raining in this game, or am I thinking of a different one? We watched a ton of football this weekend. They all do start to blend together after a little while. But then they get the experience of having Oregon State make a charge of it late. They score a couple touchdowns in the fourth quarter. This is a Power 5 opponent, not a great one, but still one that you're going to get some fight from. They made a quarterback switch, and the backup gave them a spark. But Purdue managed to, they'd steadied themselves. They held them off. Payne Durham became a reliable second option at the tight end spot to complement David Bell. And Plummer was on his spot, man. He was efficient. He was productive. The run game was really still not great, but it chipped in about what it needed. And despite giving up the two fourth quarter touchdowns, that's when Oregon State's going all out, doing what they can to make it a game. So this is a much-needed tally in Brohm's column as well, in my opinion. And I'm not saying that this...
Oregon State was, we kind of went over this, not really the pushover that you would have assumed.
Yeah.
They've got some things going, especially on offense.
Yeah.
Under, Jonathan Smith
as
their coach. But
the most anonymous man in the world. They're not as, they're not where they were 3, 4, 5 years ago, where they're one of the worst teams in FBS. No, they're improved. Not great, but they're improved.
Definitely to have that, you know, we sort of said that Purdue was in a situation where maybe Jeff Brohm was going to need to post a solid season, and that door is still open.
Yeah, very much so. So, again, it's but one step, but a good one. And now the last game of the week, both in terms of chronological order and in terms of things that really need to be said about it. Texas San Antonio 37, Illinois 30.
I remember you saying at the beginning of our recaps here that you were absolutely right and everybody should listen to you. Well, you spent the last week telling me that I was an absolute fool to even be concerned about this game, and it was just a manifestation of my self-loathing.
You, in hindsight, are completely overselling the conviction I had in this game. I thought it was I thought you shouldn't have been as pessimistic as you were.
But ultimately, it's kind of a game that I've seen time and time again. It was the Eastern Michigan game. It was kind of a bit of the Louisiana Tech. It was mostly the Eastern Michigan game. That's what it reminded me most of. That and the Western Michigan road game from 2008. But point is, you know, it doesn't matter who the coach is, doesn't matter who the athletic director is. we're going to lose these games all the goddamn time. That's just what we do. It's our identity more than anything. Brett Bielema followed the rubric to a T, complete with a bizarre punt return giving them the ball back in his second game. He already got that part of the identity. And Blake Hayes can only do so much when we pin them to the 6-yard line and they go march 94 yards and score. They did what I thought they had to do, which was to key in on Sincere McCormick and make them beat them with a passing game. And they did just that. They absolutely assassinated Devin Witherspoon. I was really surprised to see that, I don't remember the name of their receiver, which is no disrespect.
I think Franklin was the guy's last name.
That
I
was
don't
their,
remember the first
their
name.
Quarterback.
No, that's Frank Harris.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of franking
what
going on.
What did I tell you? I'm always right.
So, Zachary Franklin.
Yeah.
Had absolutely no answer for him. And then on offense, we weren't able to run the ball consistently. And there's just not really going to be an ideal outcome when you have Art Sitkowski pass the ball 43 times. He didn't turn the ball over, but that certainly wasn't for any lack of effort on his part. He had some wide open throws because guys got lost in coverage that still ended up really needing big adjustments to be caught. So, at the end of the day, Brett Bielema had an opportunity to prove that things could be different right away. And at the end of the day, prove that we weren't going to escape that thing that we always do against these teams. UTSA's first game was played in 2011, which was our last winning season. But the good news is he's got a chance to exercise this particular demon when a similar team in Charlotte comes into town in 4 weeks. Also, as I pointed out in an article, boy, we've got like half the MAC over the next few years. So, you know, if he really wants to prove that Illinois' identity isn't losing these kinds of games every single time they have the chance to, he's got opportunities. I'm not going to simply wait around for recruits to come in and then wait around for them to get starts and get in the weight room and then be seniors. I want to see a coach take 42 seniors and make them better over the course of the year, like everybody else gets to see happen. So, get to work.
There's that. Here's one question I have for you. Do you remember off the top of your head, how many transfers did Bielema bring in? I know a few.
Fair amount.
When you say a fair amount, keep in mind who you're talking to.
Yeah, no,
what's a fair amount?
I'm thinking like damn near double digits as far as guys that have seen game action are concerned.
Okay. I guess that's fair.
The amount of those that haven't played because they've gotten hurt is really stunning. We lost a defensive starter for the second week in a row. Brian Hightower, who is a Lovie Smith guy, but our number one receiver, hasn't played yet this season, nor has Notre Dame transfer Jafar Armstrong.
Peters is hurt, too.
Brandon Peters is hurt, and Illinois continues to hurt themselves by putting Derek Smith out there, starting safety. That guy is the Kevin Durant of being terrible at safety.
I think he needs
to play linebacker or something.
Sure. It's a dispiriting loss, no doubt. I'm not going to take that away from you. And I grant that, okay, forgive me for thinking you ought to be able to beat a middle-of-the-road CUSA team, even with Lovie Smith's leftovers and a couple transfers glued onto it. But I don't know that I ever called you a fool, because I trust that you know your team better than I do. I thought you were being a little overly pessimistic, and on paper, I think you were. But paper, of course, doesn't apply to the Illini. Y'all are a straight crypto-fucked-up program economy here. So I should have known better. And look, sooner or later, an opponent was going to be prepared for the tactical trickery of an even front.
And I guess on the bright side, our best receivers are former quarterbacks. Isaiah Williams is on pace to get about 80 catches this year, which is really a lot more than I expected out of him. But, you know, ultimately
And the big play threat induced span.
Yeah, that whole
that we all expected, right?
Thing is going to get annoying. I certainly hope they won't be like this, but 1-11's on the table.
Your source for Big Ten Talk, it's Off Tackle Empire!